Being an American, I would always, in his culture, be wrong, be suspect. Any other woman, especially one from his social class, seeing what I saw, would have told someone sooner or later. Then it would have been all over town. But who was I going to tell? Who ever talked to me? And who would believe me? I don't think any of this was deliberate or calculated on his part, though, any more than my reasons for marrying him were. We just fit together, and we thought, at first, it was love. Anyway, after the wedding, guess what? We had to go home and live with these people who hadn't even been informed we were marrying. Ugh, it was dreadful. They hated me. And I got the feeling they had been angry with him for quite some time already. I couldn't speak a word of Spanish. His whole family could speak English, but they wouldn't. I was totally shut out and isolated, and terribly afraid right from the beginning. He left me alone in the evenings a lot, so I just stayed in our room and finally learned to go to sleep whether he came home or not. I already knew how to suffer. I'd learned that at home. Somehow, I thought this was the price you paid to be with someone who loved you, that it was normal. He often came home drunk and amorous, and that was really awful. I could smell other women's perfume on him. One night, I'd already been asleep a long time, and some noise woke me. There was my husband, drunk, admiring himself in front of the mirror, in my nightgown. I asked him what he was doing, and he said, "Don't you think I look pretty?" He made a little face, and I saw he was wearing lipstick. Finally, something snapped. I knew I had to get out of there. Up until then, I had been miserable, but I was sure it was my fault, that somehow I could be more loving and make him want to stay with me, make him get his parents to acknowledge me, to like me even. I was willing to try harder, just like with my mother. But this was different. This was crazy. I had no money and no way of getting any, so the next day I told him I would tell his parents what he'd done if he didn't take me to San Diego. I lied and told him I had already called my mother and she was expecting to meet me, and that if he would just take me there, I'd never bother him again. I don't know where I got the courage, because I actually thought he might kill me or something, but it worked. He was so afraid of his parents knowing, you see. He drove me to the border without a word and gave me bus fare to San Diego, and about $15. So I ended up in San Diego at a friend's house. I stayed there until I got a job, and then I got a place with three roommates and began a pretty wild lifestyle. By now, I had absolutely no feelings of my own. I was completely numb. But I still had this tremendous compassion, which got me into a lot of trouble. I went home with a great many men during the next 3 or 4 years because I felt sorry for them. I'm lucky things didn't ever get really out of hand. Most of the men I got involved with had drug or alcohol problems. I met them at parties or occasionally in bars, and again, they seemed to need me to understand them, to help them, which was like a magnet for me. Lisa's attraction to men of this type made perfect sense in terms of her history with her mother. The closest thing to being loved that Lisa had experienced was being needed, so when a man appeared to need her, he was, in effect, offering her love. He did not have to be kind or giving or caring. That he was needy was enough to stir the old familiar feelings in her and kindle her caregiving response. Her story continued. My life was a mess, and so was my mother's. It will be difficult to say which of us was sicker. I was 24 when my mother got sober. She did it the hard way, all by herself, alone in her living room. She made that phone call to AA and asked for help. They sent two people over to talk to her, and they took her to a meeting that afternoon. She hasn't had a drink since. Lisa smiled softly at her mother's courage. It must have really gotten unbearable because she was a very proud lady, too proud to call unless she was desperate. Thank God I wasn't there to see it. I probably would have worked so hard to make her feel better that she never would have gotten real help. My mother had started drinking really heavily when I was about 9. I would come home from school and she would be lying on the couch, passed out, with a bottle next to her. My older sister used to get angry with me and tell me that I wouldn't look at reality because I would never admit how bad it was, but I loved my mother too much to even let myself notice that she was doing anything wrong. We were so close, she and I. So when things began to fall apart between her and my dad, I wanted to make it up to her. Her happiness was the most important thing in the world to me. I felt I had to make it all up to her for what my father was doing that hurt her, and the only thing I knew how to do was be good. So I was good in every way I knew how. I would ask her if she needed help with anything. I cooked and cleaned without being asked. I tried not to need anything for myself. But nothing worked. I realize now that I was taking on two incredibly powerful forces, my parents' deteriorating marriage and my mother's advancing alcoholism. I didn't have a chance of making it right, but that didn't keep me from trying and from blaming myself when I failed. Her unhappiness hurt me so, you see? And I knew there were still areas where I could improve. My schoolwork, for instance. I wasn't doing too well because, of course, I was under a lot of pressure at home, what with trying to take care of my brother and fixing meals and finally getting a job to help out. In school, I only had energy for one brilliant accomplishment a year. I would plan carefully and bring it off to show the teachers I wasn't dumb. But the rest of the time, I barely squeaked by. They said I wasn't really trying. Ha! They didn't know how hard I was trying to hold everything together at home. But the report cards weren't good, and my father would yell, and my mother would cry. I blamed myself for not being perfect, and I kept trying harder than ever. In a severely dysfunctional home such as this, where there are apparently insurmountable difficulties, the family will focus on other, simpler problems that hold some promise of being solvable. Lisa's schoolwork and grades thus became everyone's focus, including Lisa's. The family needed to believe that this problem was one which, if rectified, would bring harmony. The pressure on Lisa was intense. Not only was she trying to solve her parents' problems while saddled with her mother's responsibilities, she was also identified as a cause of this unhappiness. Because of the monumental proportions of her task, she never experienced success, in spite of her heroic efforts. Naturally, her sense of self-worth suffered terribly. One time, I called my best friend and said to her, "Please let me talk to you. You can read a book if you want. You don't have to listen to me. I just need someone on the other end of the phone." I didn't believe that I even deserved to have someone listen to my problems. But she did listen, of course. Her father was a recovering alcoholic who went to AA. She went to Alateen, and I think she gave me the benefit of that program just in the way she listened to me. It was so hard for me to admit anything was wrong, unless it was my father's fault. I really hated him. Lisa and I sipped our tea in silence for a few moments, while she struggled silently with bitter memories. When she could continue, she said simply, "My father left us when I was 16. My sister was already gone. She was 3 years older than I, and as soon as she turned 18, she got a full-time job and left home. That left just my mother, my brother, and me. I think that I was beginning to go under with the pressure I put on myself to keep her safe and happy, and to take care of my brother. So I went to Mexico and got married, came home and got divorced, and then ran around with a lot of men for years. It was about 5 months after my mother got into the AA program that I met Gary. The first day I spent time with him, he was stoned. We rode around in the car with my girlfriend, who knew him, and he was smoking a joint. He liked me, and I liked him, and we both separately passed on that information through my girlfriend, so pretty soon he called me and came over to visit me. I had him sit for me while I sketched him, just for fun. And I remember becoming overwhelmed with feeling for him. It was the most powerful sensation regarding a man I'd ever had. He was stoned again, and he was sitting there talking slowly, you know, the way people do on pot. And I had to stop drawing because my hands started shaking so hard I couldn't do anything. I held the sketch pad up at an angle, leaning it against my knees for stability so he couldn't see my hands shake like that. Today, I know that what I was responding to was the fact that he talked just like my mother did when she'd been drinking all day. The same long pauses and carefully selected words that came out sort of overemphasized. All the caring and love that I felt for my mother were combined with my physical attraction to him as a good-looking man. But at that time, I had no idea why I was responding the way I did. So, of course, I called it love. That Lisa's attraction to and involvement with Gary began so soon after her mother stopped drinking was not a coincidence. The tie between the two women had never been broken. Even though considerable geographic distance separated them, her mother had always been Lisa's first responsibility and deepest attachment. When Lisa realized that her mother was changing, recovering from alcoholism without her help, she reacted out of fear at not being needed. Soon, Lisa established a new relationship of depth with another addictive individual. After her marriage, her involvements with men had been casual until her mother's sobriety. She fell in love with an addict when her mother turned to members of Alcoholics Anonymous for help and support in getting well. Lisa needed a relationship with an actively addictive person in order to feel normal. She went on to describe the 6-year relationship that followed. Gary moved in with her almost at once and stated clearly during their first couple of weeks together that if there were ever a choice to be made between buying dope and paying the rent, the dope would always come first with him. Lisa, though, was sure he would change, that he would come to value what they had together and want to preserve it. She was sure she could make him love her the way she loved him. Gary rarely worked, and when he did, true to his word, his income went for the most expensive marijuana or hashish. Lisa joined him in his drug use at first, but when she found it interfered with her ability to earn a living, she stopped. She was, after all, responsible for supporting them both, and she took her responsibility seriously. Whenever she thought about telling him to leave after he'd taken money from her purse again, or there was a party going on in their apartment when she came home, exhausted from work, or he hadn't come home all night, he would buy a bag of groceries or have dinner waiting for her, or tell her he had gotten some cocaine especially for them to share, and her resolve would melt while she said to herself that he really did love her after all. His stories of his childhood would make her cry with pity for him, and Lisa was sure if she loved him enough that she could make up for all that he had suffered. She felt she must not blame him or hold him responsible for his behavior now, since he'd been so damaged as a child, and she quite forgot her own painful past as she concentrated on remedying his. Once, during an argument when she refused to give him a check her father had sent her for a birthday present, he plunged a knife into every canvas in the apartment. Lisa continued with her story. I was getting so sick by then that I actually thought, this is my fault. I shouldn't have made him so angry. I was still taking the blame for everything, trying to fix the unfixable. The next day was Saturday. Gary was gone for a while, and I was cleaning up the mess, crying and throwing out 3 years' worth of paintings. I had the television on to distract myself, and this woman who had been beaten by her husband was being interviewed. You couldn't see her face, but she was talking about how her life had been, and she described some pretty awful scenes, and then said, I didn't think it was that bad because I could still stand it. Lisa shook her head slowly. That's what I was doing, staying in this terrible situation because I could still stand it. When I heard that woman, I said aloud, but you deserve something more than the worst thing you can stand. And suddenly I heard myself, and I started crying really hard because I realized, so did I. I deserved more than the pain and the frustration and the expense and the chaos. With every ruined painting, I said to myself, I won't live this way anymore. When Gary came home, his things were packed and waiting for him outside the front door. Lisa had called her best friend, who brought her husband with her, and the couple helped Lisa to have the courage to tell Gary to leave. There wasn't a scene because my friends were there, so he just left. Later he started calling me and threatening me, but I wouldn't respond in any way, so after a while he gave up. I want you to understand, though, that I didn't do it by myself. Not respond, I mean. I called my mother that afternoon, after all the dust had settled, and told her the whole story. She told me to begin going to Al-Anon meetings for adult children of alcoholics. It was only because I was in so much pain that I listened to her. Al-Anon, like Alateen, is a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who come together to help one another and themselves recover from their obsession with the alcoholic in their lives. Adult children meetings are for the grown sons and daughters of alcoholics who want to recover from the effects of having lived as children with alcoholism. Those effects include most of the characteristics of loving too much. That was when I began to understand myself. Gary, for me, was what alcohol had been for my mother. He was a drug that I couldn't do without. Until the day I made him leave, I had always been terrified that he would go away, so I did everything I could to please him. I did all the things that I'd done as a child. Work hard, be good, not ask for anything for myself, and take care of what was someone else's responsibility. Because self-sacrifice had always been my pattern, I wouldn't have known who I was without someone to help or some suffering to endure. Lisa's deep attachment to her mother and the great sacrifice of her own needs and wants that this attachment required prepared her for later love relationships that involved suffering rather than any kind of personal fulfillment. She had made a profound decision as a child that she would rectify any difficulty in her mother's life through the power of her own love and selflessness. That decision soon became unconscious, but it continued to drive her. Totally unaccustomed to assessing ways of securing her own well-being, but expert in promoting the well-being of others, she moved into relationships that held the promise of another opportunity to make everything right for another person through the force of her love. True to her history, failure to win that love through her efforts only made her try harder. Gary, with his addiction, his emotional dependency, and his cruelty, combined all the worst attributes of Lisa's mother and father. Ironically, that accounted for her attraction to him. If the relationship we had with our parents was essentially a nurturing one, with appropriate expressions of affection, interest, and approval, then as adults, we tend to feel comfortable with people who engender similar feelings of security, warmth, and positive self-regard. Further, we will tend to avoid people who make us feel less positive about ourselves through their criticism or manipulation of us. Their behavior will be aversive for us. However, if our parents related to us in hostile, critical, cruel, manipulative, overbearing, overdependent, or otherwise inappropriate ways, that is what will feel right to us when we meet someone who expresses, perhaps very subtly, undertones of the same attitudes and behaviors. We will feel at home with people with whom our earlier unhealthy patterns of relating are recreated, and perhaps awkward and ill at ease with gentler, kinder, or otherwise healthier individuals. Or else because the challenge of trying to change someone in order to make that person happy, or to gain withheld affection or approval is missing, we may simply experience ourselves as feeling bored with healthier people. Boredom often covers mild to intense feelings of awkwardness, which women who love too much tend to feel when out of the familiar role of helping, hoping, and paying more attention to someone else's welfare than to their own. There is in most adult children of alcoholics, and in offspring from other kinds of dysfunctional homes as well, a fascination with people who spell trouble and an addiction to excitement, especially negative excitement. If drama and chaos have always been present in our lives, and if, as is so often the case, we were forced to deny many of our own feelings while growing up, we often require dramatic events to engender any feeling at all. Thus, we need the excitement of uncertainty, pain, disappointment, and struggle just to feel alive. Lisa ended her story. The peace and quiet of my life after Gary left drove me wild. It took everything I had not to call him and start it all over again, but I slowly got used to a more normal life. I'm not dating anyone now. I know that I'm still too sick to have a healthy relationship with a man. I'd go right out and find another Gary. So I'm making myself my project for the first time, rather than trying to change someone else. Lisa, in relation to Gary, like her mother in relation to alcohol, suffered from a disease process, a destructive compulsion over which she had no control by herself. Just as her mother had developed an addiction to alcohol and was unable to stop drinking on her own, so Lisa had developed what was also an addictive relationship with Gary. I do not make this analogy or use the word addictive lightly in comparing the two women's situations. Lisa's mother had become dependent on a drug, alcohol, to avoid experiencing the intense anguish and despair that her life situation held for her. The more she used alcohol to avoid feeling her pain, the more the drug operated on her nervous system to produce the very feelings she was trying to avoid. It ultimately increased rather than diminished the pain. So, of course, she drank even more. Thus, she spiraled into addiction. Lisa, too, was attempting to avoid anguish and despair. She suffered from a profound underlying depression, the roots of which traced back to her painful childhood. This underlying depression is a common factor in children from all types of severely dysfunctional homes, and their ways of dealing with it, or more typically, avoiding it, vary depending on their sex, their disposition, and their childhood role in the family. By the time they reach their teen years, many young women, like Lisa, keep their depression at bay through developing the style of loving too much. As they engage in chaotic but stimulating and distracting interactions with unhealthy men, they are too excited to sink into the depression that lingers just under the level of awareness. In this way, a cruel, indifferent, dishonest, or otherwise difficult partner becomes for these women the equivalent of a drug, creating a means of avoiding their own feelings, just as alcohol and other mood-altering substances create for drug-addicted persons a temporary avenue of escape, and one from which they dare not be separated. And as with alcohol and drugs, these unmanageable relationships that provide the needed distraction also contribute their own cargo of pain. In a parallel with the developing disease of alcoholism, dependence on the relationship deepens to the point of addiction. To be without the relationship, that is, to be alone with oneself, can be experienced as worse than being in the greatest pain the relationship produces, because to be alone means to feel the stirrings of the great pain from the past combined with that of the present. The two addictions are parallel in this way and equally difficult to overcome. A woman's addiction to her partner or to a series of unsuitable partners may owe its genesis to a variety of family problems. Ironically, adult children of alcoholics are more fortunate than those from other dysfunctional backgrounds because, at least in the larger cities, Al-Anon groups often exist to support them as they work through their problems with self-esteem and with relationships. Recovery from relationship addiction involves getting help from an appropriate support group in order to break the cycle of addiction, and to learn to seek feelings of self-worth and well-being from sources other than a man unable to foster those feelings. The key is in learning how to live a healthy, satisfying, and serene life without being dependent on another person for happiness. Sadly, for those enmeshed in addictive relationships and those caught in the web of chemical addiction, the conviction that they can handle the problem by themselves often prevents them from seeking help, and thus precludes the possibility of recovery. It is because of this conviction, I can do it on my own, that things sometimes must get so much worse before they can begin to get better for so many people struggling with either of these diseases of addiction. Lisa's life had to become hopelessly unmanageable before she could admit that she needed help to overcome her addiction to pain. And Lisa's condition wasn't helped any by the fact that both suffering for love and being addicted to a relationship are romanticized by our culture. From popular songs to opera, from classical literature to Harlequin romances, from daily soap operas to critically acclaimed movies and plays, we are surrounded by countless examples of unrewarding, immature relationships that are glorified and glamorized. Over and over again, we are instructed by these cultural models that the depth of love can be measured by the pain it causes, and that those who truly suffer, truly love. When a singer plaintively croons about not being able to stop loving someone, even though it hurts so much, there is, perhaps, because of the sheer force of repeated exposure to this point of view, something in us that accepts that what the singer expresses is the way it should be. We accept that suffering is a natural part of love, and that the willingness to suffer for the sake of love is a positive rather than a negative trait. Very few models exist of people relating as peers in healthy, mature, honest, non-manipulative, and non-exploitive ways, probably for two reasons. First, in all honesty, such relationships in real life are fairly rare. Second, since the quality of emotional interplay in healthy relationships is often much subtler than the blatant drama of unhealthy relationships, its dramatic potential is usually overlooked in literature, drama, and songs. If unhealthy styles of relating plague us, perhaps it is because that is very nearly all we see and all we know. Because of the dearth of examples of mature love and healthy communication in the media, I have been entertaining a fantasy for years of taking over the script writing for one day's episode on each of the major soap operas. In my episode, all the characters would communicate with one another in honest, non-defensive, and caring ways. No lies, no secrets, no manipulations, no one who is willing to be someone else's victim, and no one doing the victimizing. Instead, for one day, viewers would see people who are committed to having healthy relationships with each other, based on genuine communication. This style of relating would not only conflict sharply with the normal format of these programs, but would also illustrate, by way of extreme contrast, how saturated we are with depictions of exploitation, manipulation, sarcasm, revenge-seeking, deliberate baiting, piquing of jealousy, lying, threatening, coercing, and so on, none of which contribute to healthy interplay. When you think about what one segment portraying honest communication and mature love would do to the quality of these continuing sagas, consider also what the same alteration in communication style would do in each of our lives. Everything happens in a context, including the way we love. We need to be aware of the damaging shortcomings of our societal view of love, and to resist the shallow and self-defeating immaturity in personal relationships that it glamorizes. We need to consciously develop a more open and mature way of relating than what our cultural media seem to endorse, thus trading turmoil and excitement for a deeper intimacy. Chapter 4. The Need to Be Needed. I don't know how she does it all. I'd go crazy if I had to cope with what she copes with. You know, I've never heard her complain. Why does she put up with it? What does she see in him anyway? She could do so much better. People tend to say these kinds of things about a woman who loves too much, as they observe what appear to be her noble efforts to make the best of a seemingly unrewarding situation. But clues that explain the mystery of her devoted attachment can usually be found in her childhood experiences. Most of us grow up and continue in the roles we adopted in our families of origin. For many women who love too much, those roles often meant that we denied our own needs while trying to meet the needs of other family members. Perhaps we were forced by circumstances to grow up too fast, prematurely taking on adult responsibilities because our mother or father was too sick physically or emotionally to carry out the appropriate parental functions. Or perhaps a parent was absent due to death or divorce, and we tried to fill in, helping to take care of both our siblings and our remaining parent. Maybe we became the mommy at home while our own mother worked to support the family. Or we might have lived with both parents, but because one was angry or frustrated or unhappy and the other would not respond sympathetically, we found ourselves in the role of confidant, hearing details of their relationship that were too much for us to handle emotionally. We listened because we were afraid of the consequences to the suffering parent if we didn't, and afraid of the loss of love if we failed to fill the role prescribed for us. And so we didn't protect ourselves, and our parents didn't protect us either, because they needed to see us as stronger than we were. Even though we were too immature for the responsibility, we ended up protecting them. When this happened, we learned too young and too well how to take care of everyone but ourselves. Our own needs for love, attention, nurturing, and security went unmet while we pretended to be more powerful and less fearful, more grown up and less needy than we really felt. And having learned to deny our own yearning to be taken care of, we grew up looking for more opportunities to do what we had become so good at, being preoccupied with someone else's wants and demands rather than acknowledging our own fear and pain and unmet needs. We've been pretending to be grown up for so long, asking for so little and doing so much, that now it seems too late to take our turn. So we help and help and hope that our fear will go away and our reward will be love. Melanie's story is a case in point, an example of how growing up too fast with too much responsibility, in this case, filling in for an absent parent, can create a compulsion to nurture. The day we met, right after a lecture I had given to a group of nursing students, I couldn't help but notice that her face was a study in contrasts. The small, upturned nose with its splash of freckles and the deeply dimpled cheeks of buttermilk skin gave her an appealingly impish air. Those sprightly features seemed out of place on the same countenance that displayed such dark circles beneath her clear gray eyes. From under a cap of dark auburn waves, she looked like a pale, tired pixie. She had waited off to one side as I spoke at some length with each of the half-dozen nursing students who had lingered behind once my lecture had ended. As frequently happened whenever I spoke on the subject of the family disease of alcoholism, several students wanted to discuss matters too personal for the usual question-answer chat period following my presentation. When the last of her classmates had gone, Melanie allowed me a moment's hiatus and then introduced herself, shaking my hand warmly and firmly for someone as slight and delicate as she was. She had waited so long and so patiently to speak to me that in spite of her apparent self-assuredness, I suspected a depth of feeling had been tapped by the morning's lecture. To give her an opportunity to talk at length, I invited her to join me in a walk across campus. As I gathered my belongings and we left the lecture hall, she chatted companionably, but once we were outside in the gray November noon, she became quietly reflective. We walked along a deserted path, the only sound the powdery crackle of fallen sycamore leaves, brittle beneath our feet. Melanie fell out of step to scuff at a couple of the ragged star shapes, their pointed tips curling upward like dried starfish, exposing their pale undersides. After a while, she said softly, "My mother wasn't an alcoholic, but from what you described this morning about the way that disease affects a family, she might as well have been. She was mentally ill, really very crazy, and it finally killed her. She suffered from deep depressions, went to the hospital a lot, and sometimes stayed away a long time. The drugs they used to cure her just seemed to make her worse. Instead of an alert crazy woman, she became a zoned-out crazy woman. But as zonked as those drugs kept her, she finally managed to make one of her suicide attempts stick. Although we tried never to leave her by herself, that day we had all gone off in different directions just for a little while. She hanged herself in the garage. My father found her. She shook her head quickly, unsettling the dark memories that were gathering there, and continued. I heard a lot that I could identify with this morning, but you said in your lecture that children of alcoholics or from other dysfunctional homes like ours very often choose partners who are alcoholic or addicted to other drugs, and that's not true of Sean. He doesn't care much about drinking or getting loaded, thank God, but we do have other problems. She looked away from me, lifting her chin. I can usually handle anything, the chin lowered, but it's beginning to get to me. Then she looked squarely at me, smiled, and shrugged. I'm running out of food and money and time, that's all. She said this as though it were the punchline of a joke, to be responded to with amusement, not to be taken seriously. I had to prod her for the details, which she reported matter-of-factly. Sean's gone again. We have 3 children, Susie, 6, Jimmy, 4, and Peter, who is 2.5. I'm working part-time as a ward clerk going for my RN in nursing school and trying to keep it all together at home. Sean usually watches the kids when he's not in art school or gone. She said this without a trace of bitterness. We were married 7 years ago. I was 17 and right out of high school. He was 24, doing some acting and going to school part-time. He had an apartment with 3 friends. I used to go over on Sundays and make them all these great feasts. I was his Sunday night date. Fridays and Saturdays he was either doing a stage performance or seeing someone else. Anyway, they all loved me at that apartment. My cooking was the greatest thing that happened to them all week. They used to tease Sean, telling him he ought to marry me and let me take care of him. I guess he liked the idea because that's what he did. He asked me to marry him, and of course I said yes. I was thrilled. He was so handsome. Look. She opened her purse and took out a little sheaf of plastic-encased photographs. The first one was of Sean, dark eyes, chiseled cheekbones, and a deeply cleft chin combined in a broodingly handsome face. It was a wallet-sized version of what looked like a photograph taken for an actor's or model's portfolio. I asked whether this was the case, and Melanie confirmed that it was, naming a well-known photographer who had done the work. He looks like a perfect Heathcliff, I observed, and she nodded proudly. We looked together at the other pictures, which showed 3 children in various stages of their development, crawling, taking tottering steps, blowing out birthday candles. Hoping to see a less posed photograph of Sean, I commented that he wasn't in any of the children's pictures. No, he usually takes the pictures. He's had quite a background in photography, as well as acting in art. Does he work in any of those fields now? I asked. Well, no. His mother sent him some money, so he took off for New York again, to see what opportunities there are for him there. Her voice dropped, almost imperceptibly. Given her obvious loyalty to Sean, I would have expected Melanie to sound hopeful regarding this foray to New York. Since she did not, I asked, Melanie, what is it? With the first trace of complaint, she said, The problem isn't our marriage, it's his mother. She keeps sending him money. Every time he's about to settle down with us or is sticking to a job for a change, she'll send him a check and off he goes. She can't say no to him. If she'd just stop giving him money, we'd be all right. What if she never stops? I asked. Then Sean will have to change. I'll make him see how he's hurting us. Tears appeared on her dark lashes. He'll have to refuse when she offers him money. Melanie, that doesn't sound too likely from what you're telling me. Her voice rose and became more determined. She's not going to ruin this thing. He will change. Melanie found an especially large leaf, and for the next several steps, she kicked it ahead of her, watching it disintegrate. I waited a few moments and then asked, Is there more? Still kicking away, Melanie answered, He's been to New York lots of times, and he has someone else he sees when he's there. Softly again, and again, matter-of-factly. Another woman? I asked, and Melanie looked away as she nodded. How long has he been involved? Oh, years, really. At this point, Melanie actually shrugged. It started with my first pregnancy. I almost didn't blame him. I was so sick and miserable, and he was so far away. Amazingly, Melanie assumed the blame for Sean's infidelity to her, as well as the burden of supporting him and their children, while he dabbled at various careers. I asked her if she had ever considered divorce. Actually, we did separate once. That's silly to say, because we're separated all the time with his going off the way he does, but once I said I wanted a separation, mostly to teach him a lesson, and so for almost 6 months we really were apart. He'd still call me, and I would send him money when he needed it, if some opportunity were about to break and he needed something to tide him over until it did. But for the most part, we were each on our own. I even met two other men. Melanie sounded surprised that other men would be interested in her. She puzzled. Both of them were so nice to the children, and they each wanted to help me around the house, fixing up what needed repairing, and even buying me little things that I needed. It was nice having them treat me that way, but the feelings were just never really there on my part. I could never feel anything like the attraction that I still felt for Sean, so eventually I went back to him. She grinned. Then I had to explain to him why everything was in such good shape at home. We were halfway across the campus, and I wanted to know more about what Melanie's childhood had been like, to understand the experiences that had prepared her for the hardship of her present situation. When you remember yourself as a child, what do you see? I asked, and watched her brow furrow as she looked back through the years. Oh, that's funny. I see myself in my apron standing on a stool in front of the stove, stirring a pot. I was the middle child of five, and I was 14 when my mother died, but I started cooking and cleaning long before that because she was so sick. She just never came out of the back room after a while. My two older brothers got jobs after school to help out, and I sort of took over as mother for everybody. My two sisters were 3 and 5 years younger than I, so it was up to me to do almost everything at home. But we managed okay. Daddy worked and shopped. I cooked and cleaned. We did all we could. Money was always scarce, but we made do. Daddy worked awfully hard, frequently holding down two jobs. So he was gone from home much of the time. I think he stayed away partly because he had to and partly to avoid my mother. We all avoided her as much as we could. She was so difficult. My father remarried when I was a senior in high school. Things immediately became easier because his new wife worked too and had a daughter the same age as my youngest sister, who was 12 then. Everything just blended together. Money wasn't such a problem. Dad was much happier. There was enough to go around for, really, the first time. I asked, "What were your feelings about your mother's death?" Melanie set her jaw. The person who died had not been my mother for many years. She was someone else, someone who slept or screamed and made trouble. I remember her when she was still my mother, but it's vague. I have to go way back to someone who was soft and sweet and used to sing while she worked or played with us. You know, she was Irish, and she would sing such melancholy songs. Anyway, I think we were relieved when she finally died, but I felt guilty, too, that maybe if I'd only understood her better or cared more, she wouldn't have gotten so sick. I don't think about it if I can help it. We were nearing my destination, and in the few moments we had left, I hoped to help Melanie see at least a glimpse of the origin of her troubles in the present. Do you see any similarities between your life as a child and now? I asked. She gave an uncomfortable little laugh. More than ever before, just talking about it now. I see how I'm still waiting for Sean to come home, just as I waited for my father when he was gone. And I realize how I never blame Sean for what he's doing because I've got his going away all mixed up in my mind with my father going away so that he could take care of us all. I can see how it's not the same thing, and yet I feel the same way about it, as if I should just make the best of it. She paused, squinting to look harder at the patterns unfolding before her. Oh, and I'm still the brave little Melanie, holding it all together, stirring the pot on the stove, taking care of the children. Her creamy cheeks flushed pink with the shock of recognition. So it's true what you said in your lecture about children like I was. We do find people with whom we can play the same roles we did when we were growing up. As we parted, Melanie hugged me hard and said, Thanks for listening. I just needed to talk about it a little, I guess. And I do understand better, but I'm not ready to quit. Not yet. Her spirits were obviously lighter as she said, Chin up again. Besides, Sean just needs to grow up, and he will. He's got to, don't you think? Without waiting for a reply, she turned and strode through the fallen leaves. Melanie's insight had indeed deepened, but many other similarities between her childhood and her present life still remained outside her awareness. Why would a bright, attractive, energetic, and capable young woman like Melanie need a relationship so fraught with pain and hardship as was hers with Sean? Because for her and other women who have grown up in deeply unhappy homes, where the emotional burdens were too heavy and the responsibilities too great, for these women, what feels good and what feels bad have become confused and entangled, and finally one and the same. For instance, in Melanie's home, parental attention was negligible due to the general unmanageability of life as the family tried to cope with the mother's disintegrating personality. Melanie's heroic efforts to manage the household were rewarded with the closest thing to love she was to experience, her father's grateful dependency on her. The feelings of fear and being burdened that would be natural to a child in such circumstances were overshadowed by her sense of competence, which grew out of her father's need for her help and her mother's inadequacy. Heady stuff for a child, to be treated as stronger than one parent and indispensable to the other. This childhood role formed her identity as a savior who could rise above difficulty and chaos, rescuing those around her through her courage, strength, and indomitable will. This savior complex sounds healthier than it is. While to have strength in a crisis is laudable, Melanie, like other women of similar backgrounds, needed crises in order to function. Without uproar, stress, or a desperate situation to manage, the buried childhood feelings of being emotionally overwhelmed would surface and become too threatening. As a child, Melanie was her father's helper, as well as mother to the other children. But she was also a child in need of parenting, and since her mother was too disturbed emotionally, and her father too unavailable, her own needs went unmet. The other children had Melanie to fuss over them, worry about them, take care of them. Melanie had no one. Not only was she without a mother, she also had to learn to think and act like an adult. There was no place, no time for expressing her own panic, and soon that very lack of opportunity to take her turn emotionally began to feel right to her. If she pretended hard enough to be a grown-up, she could manage to forget that she was a frightened child. Soon, Melanie not only functioned well in chaos, she actually required it to function at all. The burden she shouldered helped her avoid her own panic and pain. It weighed her down and brought her relief at the same time. Further, the sense of worth she developed resulted from carrying responsibilities that were very nearly beyond her capabilities as a child. She earned approval by working hard, taking care of others, and sacrificing her own wants and needs to theirs. Thus, martyrdom also became part of her personality, and combined with her savior complex to make Melanie a virtual magnet for someone who spelled trouble, someone like Sean. It is helpful to very briefly review some important aspects of child development in order to better understand the forces at work in Melanie's life. Because, due to the unusual circumstances of her childhood, what would have otherwise been normal feelings and reactions became dangerously exaggerated in Melanie. For children growing up in a nuclear family, it is natural to entertain strong wishes to be rid of the same-sex parent so as to have the beloved opposite-sex parent all to themselves. Little boys heartily wish that Daddy would disappear so that they could have all of Mommy's love and attention. And little girls dream of replacing their mothers as Daddy's wife. Most parents have received proposals from their young children of the opposite sex that express this yearning. A 4-year-old boy says to his mother, "When I grow up, I'm going to marry you, Mommy." Or a 3-year-old girl says to her father, "Daddy lets you and me have our own house together without Mommy." These very normal yearnings reflect some of the strongest feelings a young child experiences. Yet, should something actually happen to the envied rival, resulting in that parent's harm or absence from the family, the effect on the child can be devastating. When the mother in such a family is emotionally disturbed, severely and chronically ill physically, alcoholic or drug addicted, or otherwise physically or emotionally absent for whatever reason, then the daughter, usually the oldest daughter, if there are two or more, is almost invariably elected to fill the position left vacant due to the mother's illness or absence. Melanie's story exemplifies the effects of such a promotion on a young girl. Due to the presence of debilitating mental illness in her mother, Melanie fell heir to the position of female head of household. During the years when her own identity was forming, she was, in many respects, her father's partner rather than his daughter. As they discussed and managed the problems of the household, they operated as a team. In a sense, Melanie had her father all to herself because she had a relationship with him that was profoundly different from what her siblings had. She was very nearly his peer. She was also, for several years, much stronger and more stable than her sick mother. This meant that Melanie's normal childhood wishes to have her father all to herself were realized, but at the cost of her mother's health and, finally, her mother's life. What happens when one's early childhood wishes to be rid of the same-sex parent and obtain the opposite-sex parent for one's own come true? There are three extremely powerful character-determining and unconsciously operating consequences. The first is guilt. Melanie felt guilty when she recalled her mother's suicide and her failure to prevent it, the kind of consciously experienced guilt any family member naturally feels in the face of such a tragedy. In Melanie, this conscious guilt was exacerbated by her overdeveloped sense of responsibility for the welfare of all her family members. But in addition to this heavy burden of conscious guilt, she carried another, even heavier load. The realization of her childhood wishes to have her father to herself produced in Melanie an unconscious guilt in addition to the conscious guilt she felt for not saving her mentally ill mother from suicide. This in turn generated a drive for atonement, a need to suffer and endure hardship as expiation. This need, combined with Melanie's familiarity with a martyr's role, created in her something close to masochism. There was comfort, if not actual pleasure, in her relationship with Sean, with all its inherent pain, loneliness, and overwhelming responsibility. The second consequence is unconscious feelings of discomfort at the sexual implications of having the desired parent to oneself. Ordinarily, the presence of the mother, or, in these days, a frequent divorce, another companion and sexual partner for the father, such as a stepmother or girlfriend, provides safety for both father and daughter, The daughter is free to develop a sense of herself as attractive and beloved in the eyes of her father, while protected from overt acting out of the sexual impulses inevitably generated between them by the strength of his bond with an appropriate adult female. An incestuous relationship did not develop between Melanie and her father, but given their circumstances, it certainly could have. The dynamics operating in their family are very frequently present when incestuous relationships develop between fathers and daughters. When a mother, for whatever reason, abdicates her appropriate role as her husband's partner and her child's parent, and causes a daughter to be elevated to that position, she is forcing her daughter not only to take over her responsibilities, but also to be at risk of becoming the object of the father's sexual advances. While this might sound as if all responsibility lies with the mother, in fact, it is always the father's complete responsibility if incest occurs. This is because, as the adult, it is his duty to protect his child rather than to ever use her for his sexual gratification. Further, even if the father never approaches the daughter sexually, the lack of a strong couple bond between the parents and the daughter's assumption of her mother's role in the family serve to heighten feelings of sexual attraction between father and daughter. Because of their close relationship, the daughter may be uncomfortably aware that her father's special interest in her is tinged at some level with sexual overtones, or the unusual emotional availability of her father may cause the daughter to focus her burgeoning sexual feelings on him more than she would under ordinary circumstances. In an effort to avoid violating, even in thought, the powerful incest taboo, she may numb herself to most or even all of her sexual feelings. The decision to do so is, again, unconscious, a defense against the most threatening impulse of all, sexual attraction for a parent. Because it is unconscious, the decision is not easily examined and reversed. The result is a young woman who may be uncomfortable with any sexual feelings because of the unconscious taboo violations connected with them. When this happens, nurturing may be the only safe expression of love. Melanie's primary mode of relating to Sean was to feel responsible for him. This had long since become her way of feeling and expressing love. When she was 17, her father replaced Melanie with his new wife, a marriage that she apparently welcomed with relief. That she felt so little bitterness at the loss of her role at home was probably due in large part to the appearance of Sean and his roommates, for whom she performed many of the same functions she had previously performed at home. If that situation had not developed into a marriage between Sean and herself, Melanie might have faced a profound identity crisis at this point. As it was, she immediately became pregnant, thus recreating her caretaking role, while Sean cooperated by beginning, like her father, to be absent much of the time. She sent him money even when they were separated, competing with his mother to be the woman who took care of him best. This was a competition she had already won with her own mother in relationship to her own father. When, during her separation from Sean, men appeared in her life who did not require her mothering, who, in fact, attempted to reverse roles with her by offering her much-needed help, she could not relate emotionally to them. She was only comfortable as the caregiver. The sexual dynamics of Melanie's relationship with Sean had never provided the powerful bond between them that his need for her caretaking did. In fact, Sean's infidelity simply provided Melanie with another reflection of her childhood experience. Because of her advancing mental illness, Melanie's mother became an increasingly vague, barely visible other woman in the back room of the house, emotionally and physically removed from Melanie's life and thoughts. Melanie managed her relationship with her mother by keeping a distance and not thinking about her. Later, when Sean had another love interest, this woman, too, was vague and far away, not perceived as a real threat to what was, like her earlier relationship with her father, a somewhat asexual but practical partnership. Remember, Sean's behavior was not unprecedented. Before they ever married, his established pattern had been to seek other women's company while allowing Melanie to take care of his practical, less romantic needs. Melanie knew this, and yet married him.